The following Dharma discourse was given by Jeffrey Shugen Arnold at Zen Mountain Monastery. Shugen Roshi is the head of the Mountains and Rivers Order and abbot of the monastery. This talk, like all of our talks, is offered free of charge. If you would like to make a donation or find out more about our various programs, visit us online at zmm.org. Thank you for listening.
This is from Master Dogen's 300 Koan Shobogenzo, the main case. One day, Zen Master Baoji Panchan went to the marketplace and overheard a customer speaking to the butcher. The customer said, "Cut a fine piece for me." The butcher threw down his knife, folded his hands, and said, "Sir, is there any piece that is not fine?" Upon hearing these words, Panchan had an awakening. Dharma Roshi's commentary. Panchan unexpectedly stumbles upon something extraordinary. Although the butcher doesn't look like a lion, he nevertheless roars like one. But tell me, what awakened Panchan? Haven't you heard the Diamond Sutra saying all things are equal, not some things high and other things low? This being the case, why then are the Rocky Mountains high and the Catskill Mountains low? You should understand that no thing ever falls short of its own completeness. Wherever it stands, it never fails to cover the ground. Since the totality of existence is contained in each and everything, what is the origin of the scale that you use to evaluate? See into it here, and you'll have seen into Panchan's awakening. The verse, if you speak of gain and loss, you're a person of gain and loss. Don't you see? The tall one is a tall Buddha, the short one, a short Buddha. Good morning. Good morning to those of you who are at home or wherever you might be. So this weekend we have been having many of you here for this introduction to Zen training, to this noble path of the Eightfold Path. And the Buddha spoke about noble friends as being the Sangha, the noble path. And noble in this sense is that which is in accord, which is in harmony with the nature of things, with reality, with each other, that is in harmony with the highs and lows, with differentiation. Societies assign high and low to people based on birth and class and race and gender and sexual orientation. The Buddha said all of those are designations. They're conventions that we use. They have no real basis. They have no ultimate standard. They are no scale by which to measure people. But that doesn't stop us. In the Vasetta Sutta that we studied a little bit earlier this week in the Mando, where these two young Brahmins were coming to the Buddha, so these are high class, high caste people at the Buddha's time who were debating between themselves over what constitutes being deserving of that high position. And the Buddha said, "I don't call one a Brahmin simply because they were born of a mother or sprung forth from a womb." In other words, it's not something that comes with birth. It's nothing inherent. He said, but rather someone with nothing, who clings to nothing, who's beyond attachment and unshackled. This person is who I call a Brahmin or a noble being, having put aside violence against being fearful or firm. They neither kill nor do they get others to kill. This is who I call a noble being, unopposing among opposition, unbound among the armed, unclinging among those who cling. They discern right here for themselves, on their own ending of stress, their own liberation from suffering. Unshackled, they lay their burden down. This is the person that I call a Brahmin, a noble being. So he took a term and a classification of a whole group of people that had a very defined and sort of definite meaning an intrinsic meaning, and he liberated it. He liberated it from the confines of that definition, of that understanding, and in so doing was trying to liberate both those who were identifying with that as well as those who were identified as not that. And so this weekend we've been studying this Dharma path. You've been immersed within what we call the three treasures, the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha, which constitutes the totality, not just of the Buddhist tradition, but of the whole world, the whole universe, when it's understood. Recognizing that in this world, it's difficult to find our way through the interlocking circles, realms of greed, aversion, confusion, delusion, pride, jealousy, intolerance, fear. And so the seeker, knowingly or not yet conscious, begins to seek, is there actually a path that has been discovered to be true? Is there a way? Is there a way through this? Is there a way into this that is true, that is trustworthy of your time and your devotion of energy? Have others walked it and tested it? In order for there to be such a path, it has to be universal. In other words, if the Buddha's teaching was specific to his time and place, we wouldn't be sitting here, right? Because it would have no relevance. It would have no efficacy for anybody outside of that time and place. It would not be universal. So it has to be open to all in every time, in every place, in every culture. But being universal, it also has to be completely true here, right? In this specific time and place. It also has to be something you can actually do, right? It would be nice if there was a path that was universal and was here right now, but sorry, it's not for you. What good would that be? So all of those have to be true. All of those are true of Buddha Dharma. Master Dogen in Mendoa said, all Buddhas who individually transmit the inconceivable Dharma, the inexpressible, the undefinable Dharma, actualizing unsurpassable complete enlightenment, have a wondrous art, supreme and unconditioned. It's not the creation, it's not the production, it's not the result of any person's effort. The Buddha didn't sit down and create the Dharma. He taught, he spent his whole life expounding and finding ways to give language to something that is essentially inexpressible, to guide us on a path that in essence has no signposts. And he was quite skilled at doing those things. Have a wondrous art, supreme and unconditioned. Receptive samadhi, concentration, is its mark. That is the wondrous art. Only Buddhas transmit it to Buddhas without veering off. Sitting upright, practicing Zen, is the authentic gate to free yourself in the unconfined realm of this samadhi, this wondrous art. Samadhi is one of the Eightfold Path. It is the development of mindfulness into a very focused and powerful state of concentration. Dogen goes on to say, although this inconceivable Dharma is abundant in every person, we all possess it. It's not actualized without practice. It doesn't become actual unless we practice it. And it's not experienced without realization. And if it's not experienced, then in that way it remains unknown to us. It's as though it doesn't exist because it's not known to us. Dogen says, when you release it, it fills your hand. How could it be limited to one or many? When you speak it, it fills your mouth. It's not bound by length or width. All Buddhas continually abide in this Dharma and don't leave traces of consciousness where they are. Sentient beings consciously move about in this Dharma, but where they are is not clear in their consciousness. The concentrated endeavor of the way I'm speaking of allows all things to come forth in realization to practice going beyond in this path of letting go. Passing through the barrier of duality and dropping off the limitations of grasping, of attachment, of the self. In this way, how could you then be hindered by concepts and theories? So Dogen says, although abundant in each person, we call that Buddha nature, it needs to be actualized. There's very little chance of it being actualized unless we practice, and so we practice. To actualize means to make it actual, to make it real, alive, manifest. So we practice in this path of letting go, continually going beyond in this path of letting go, because our inclination is to, we let go. It's like walking along a ledge, you know, and looking for grab holds, something you can grab onto. So you let go of this, but you grab onto the next one, right? And then you take a few steps forward, you let go of that, but then you grab onto the next one. And so with each letting go, we often replace that. If I let go of this attachment, of this sense of myself, of this, then who am I? Right? So Dogen makes it very clear to go beyond, continually be going beyond. So in that way, the practice is rather merciless. Right? Because we're constantly looking for a place to just rest. Right? To stop. This is good enough. Can I just hang out here for a while? Right? This is good enough. And so we have the Eightfold Path. We have 8 gates of training. And so in a retreat like this, some of you may come and go from this weekend and have the sense now, a greater clarity, that maybe your path is in another direction. Maybe it's another school of Buddhism. Maybe it's not Buddhism at all. Good. Now you have more clarity. Or you may leave this weekend thinking this is your path. If that's so, or rather in either case, something needs to be practiced. You know, part of coming together and practicing together, talks, discussions, is to guide and inspire, right? We all know how powerful it is when we are inspired, we are moved. It raises something in us, it gives us a sense of a possibility, there's an opening, there's a doorway, and there's energy in that, there's enthusiasm. And then we leave, you leave, and you enter back into the many things of your life. And that wondrous, beautiful, lively infant begins to wither. All right. And so an essential part of practice is how do you continue to keep that fire burning brightly? Dogen says human beings continuously move about in this Dharma, we're continuously moving about in this true reality that is peaceful by its nature, that is without conflict, that is free of bias and prejudice, of highs and lows, of dividing and conquering. But where we are is not clear in our consciousness. We're in the midst of it, we don't see it. There's an old phrase of sitting by the water, crying out for thirst. All of these ways of trying to convey this sense of being already complete. Because elsewise, we, in our sense of incompleteness, of insufficiency, We go looking somewhere, to someone, for something to fill that void. And so this is, in a sense, our basic delusion. It's being in the midst, and yet it is not clear in our consciousness. Something else is clear. The way we see ourselves, the way we see the world, our attachments, our belief in those attachments, our passion for those attachments. So I spoke last week of a sutra that talked about that in our confusion, we don't have a right relationship between our mind and our senses, our emotions, our thoughts, the objects that we perceive in the world. We have a relationship. We're constantly interacting, but it's not a right relationship. Right here means true, trustworthy. And so Dogen says, sitting upright, practicing Zen, jhana, meditation is the authentic gate to free yourself in the unconfined realm of the samadhi. And so Zazen is one of the most powerful things we will ever encounter if we allow ourselves to be shown that, and that we begin to experience in time that unconfined realm, a realm, a moment, an experience in which that confinement drops away. And it's not because you have created a state of non-confinement. That ultimately will confine you. It's because we have stopped creating all of those many states. In this koan, it's kind of an interesting koan. My own opinion, it's not a great koan. What do I mean by that? It's not a great koan. But in terms of what it offers, in terms of actually practicing this, taking this up. But the reason I wanted to, this collection of koans, Dogen brought back all of these from his journeys to China. And then he used a lot of these as seeds for his other teachings, like in the Shobo Genzo. And some of them he didn't use, either because they weren't useful to him, or maybe he didn't live long enough. But he thought this one worthy to bring back, and so for that reason alone, it's worth bringing out. But there are some elements in it that are kind of interesting, which is why I wanted to bring it out. The koan is a way of training. It's a way of practicing Zazen, first and foremost. It's a form of meditation, just as practicing the breath in various ways, practicing shikantaza, doing visualization practices. There are many different forms of meditation in Buddhism. They all share some common elements, but they direct your mind in different ways. They present you with the world in different ways, inside and outside. And the koan is a very somewhat unique form of spiritual training and meditation in the Zen tradition. We can think of it as a direct inquiry. So Buddhism is really based in the path of examination. It's very engaged. It's wanting to understand. It's wanting to question, to reflect on, to doubt, to begin to doubt the sort of self-evident, unexamined assumptions of our world, our culture, ourselves. But how do we do that? How do we examine? How do you ask an essential question? What does that look like? And how do you ask it in a way that doesn't lead to reams of pages and pages of intellectual, conceptual ideas? The koan provides the student a training ground for that. In a way, it helps us to reclaim or rediscover or strengthen our natural capacity for very deep, direct examination into the nature of things. And here it uses that most dangerous of things, words and language, right? Which have meaning, which is exactly what we get entangled in, right? And so it uses, in a sense, the poison, right? What we sort of get so entangled in as medicine. And so in the process of doing koan training, students are learning how to liberate, not language, because language by in and of itself is free. It's not bound. but it helps us to liberate ourselves, our minds, from the confinement, how we confine ourselves in language. I was reading a passage of Christopher Cleary, who did some writings and collections around koans, and he said many Westerners, this is a little dated, but he said many Westerners believe koans to be anti-rationalist. They're often described as paradoxes or puzzles, or he said that people project their favorite alternatives to rationality, subjectivism, intuition, intuitive, instinctive feeling, all sorts of emotionalism and irrationalism. The koans are irrational, which is not true. But they're not based in the reference system that we use all the time, the scale that we use to evaluate. Rather, they make full use of both the conceptual, the rational, and the non-conceptual. You might think of the super-rational aspect of mind. And they also provide a very, very powerful way for teachers to examine and test and sharpen and clarify the mind of the student. So in this story, Panchen, who is a disciple of Matsu, so this is early 9th century China, and Matsu was one of the great sort of luminous teachers in the history of Zen. He had many, many disciples. He was said to be a very imposing, large, very large-bodied, very imposing teacher. And Panchen was his disciple. So one day, he's just in the market, he's walking around, and overhears this conversation where a customer is asking, give me the best cut of meat that you have. And the butcher throws down the knife and folds his arms and says, sir, what piece of meat is not fine? And at this, Panchen is awakened. It's said in the Mando, it says, these words reverberated through Panchen. And then Matsu confirmed his awakening. And that can be deceptive. You know, these words do not convey the experience, because they make it sound like, you know, you just have a feeling or a particular moment of something, right? And that's an enlightenment experience. Like it's a moment of being startled. You know, it's, as I've said, it's in a way, it's much, much easier to misunderstand the Dharma than it is to understand it well. And particularly as it, you know, gets into popular culture, as it has, and phrases and words get thrown around and get picked up by other people in other disciplines and appropriated and so on. And so it's easy to have misconceptions about letting go, about non-attachment, and understand it, misunderstand it as not caring or being distant or turning away from something. It's really our ordinary, distracted, conditioned mind that breeds not caring, that often leads us to turn away or become distant. True letting go brings us closer, always, because we're letting go of that which separates us, that which tends to shut us down. So Zazen, in fact, is really helping us to do the most difficult of things, which is to care very deeply for something, but without clinging. You know, sometimes students will come into Dokusan and argue and say, it's not possible to love or to be passionate about something, to really care about something, work on it without attachment, right? It can be so hard to see those as different things. But they are different things. And we don't figure this out. We experience, we work it out through our actual practice, because if you don't care about your sitting, your zazen's not really going to develop very well, right? So if it is important to you, if you don't care about your practice, if that's not something that you really want to have give meaning to in your life, then it will have a different place in your life, right? It might be none, it might be very slight, it might be very, very casual, all of which is fine. I mean, those are all choices that we can make. But if it is something that we want to be meaningful, to be impactful, to have a make a difference in our life, then we have to care about it, which means we have to do what we do when we care about something. We have to engage it. We have to give it energy. We have to make time and place for it. We have to tend to it like a garden, like a relationship. And in that way, as we care about it, we will find ourselves creating expectations and all kinds of fantasies about what's going to happen next and when, and we're quite sure that all of this is going to work out just according to our schedule, and it doesn't, ever. And then we begin to realize, oh, I am on the path of going beyond letting go. Panchan once said to his Sangha, "O Zen worthies, to successfully practice the way is like the earth, which while upholding the mountains and rivers and the great plains is completely unaware. It's like jade that is concealed within stone. The stone is unaware of the jade's flawless nature. Those who practice in this way may be said to have left home, to have left the home of our self-clinging, of our attachments, of our habit patterns." All Buddhas continuously abide in this Dharma. So Panchan was in the market. He heard this conversation. "Sir, is there any piece that is not fine?" Now the butcher, we can assume, was talking about his meat. Fresh, juicy, tender. And Panchan heard that, but he heard it on a whole nother plane. How is that possible? Because he was a practitioner. His mind was awake and alert and relaxed. Quite possibly, he was not thinking about the Dharma. He was not thinking about realization. Almost certainly, he was not. And so in that way, but he was a practitioner, he was a monastic, which meant he was devoting lots of energy to his meditation, to his inquiry and examination. But in that moment, we can pretty reliably imagine that his mind was quite relaxed. And then that the simple words of the butcher cut right through. And that there was no intention of the butcher to have that effect. And it's a kind of a wonderful window into how when we are practicing being awake and we are inquiring into our lives, that it brings our mind to a state of alertness, of ripeness, where ordinary things have different levels of potential, right? Things come alive. They've always been alive. But now we experience their aliveness. We see them. There's an openness so they can actually enter. I've been speaking recently about affinity. It's like in that moment, Panchan's mind was in complete affinity with the Dharma. And so he heard those simple words, and he heard them at a fundamental level that freed him. In that moment, there was no opposition. There was no being bound. There was no clinging. He was unshackled. In that moment, his burden was laid down. I was reading recently a teaching by Longchenpa, who's a very well-known Tibetan master. And he was talking about very much a practice, sort of teaching about practice. He was talking about those who are not proper vessels of the Dharma. He said those who are attached to fame and worldly things, those who are puffed up with pride and have no reverence for holy beings, for enlightened beings, or sacred things, we might say. The minds are fickle, without any constancy, without any stability. Everything is a show. For substances of practice, they have no regard. Everything is a performance. For the real sort of essence, the substance, the power of practice, there's no interest. from guest at meditation. From guest, I'm guessing at my meditation. They expect immediate results. I hear that as not actually practicing meditation according to what the teachings are saying, but just sort of doing what comes naturally, doing what I like, doing what feels good, doing what's easy, and then expecting immediate results. The many teachings they know or seen arrive these days, it's possible to know, have access to all kinds of teachings. But Longchenpo is saying, but we may have them, but we see them askew. We don't see them clearly. They falsely praise themselves and others. They defame, they cultivate malevolence, a kind of negative mind. To all such people, do not give the teachings. Keep them concealed. Kind of interesting within the bodhisattva path of liberating all beings. And there is a teaching of being generous with the teachings when people are seeking. But there's a caution that when they're not seeking or they're not ready, that we might actually turn them away, or they might be misused because the person's mind is not attuned. They're not actually seeking what is true. They're seeking something else. But we might look at this list and think, uh-oh, like, I can find myself in there, you know. Who could not find themselves in here? So what's the difference? Right? Well, because we can all fall into those at different times. The difference is when someone has a sincere heart, they are actually seeking the Dharma. Those different sort of states may arise, but that's not actually what we're trying to do. That's not what we're devoted to doing. That's just our habits. Those are patterns that appear. Of course they're going to appear. Those people are worthy vessels of the Dharma. And so those moments of feeling inadequate or incomplete, you know, feeling insecure, having self-doubt, I mean, that is so prevalent within Buddhist practitioners today. And that's not an accident. We are studying karma. How does that come to be? Why? We can look at it in a personal, our own individual lives, you know, our families. Maybe we didn't get much support when we grew up, or we were criticized a lot. Nothing was ever good enough. And understanding that can help us to understand that it's not who you are. It may be what you've learned. It's not who you are. But how can it be so prevalent? Do we live in a culture that, in a sense, on certain levels, manufactures discontent, manufactures insecurity, manufactures a sense of incompleteness? You know, there are stories that when the first teachers started coming over here, and here, there's a story of the Dalai Lama being at a conference of Western teachers, and these Western teachers were talking about this sort of prevalence of insecurity and self-doubt. And the Dalai Lama was confused. He was like trying to talk through his translator. Is this a form of mental illness? And they said, oh, no. It's very common. And he's like, but you're Buddhas. You have this essential nature. This is who you are. Why? And it was such an eye-opener, I think, for those teachers to think, oh, wait a minute. This isn't just universal human nature. Is there something about our time and place that instills this on a grand level that we carry then into our practice and then have to really meet and address in a very skillful way? Is there anything that is not fine, the butcher says. So Dada Roshi says, all things are equal, the Diamond Sutra, a central teaching of our tradition. Not some things are, there is no high and low. But then he asks the question, but then Rocky Mountains are high, Catskill Mountains are low. What are we to do about that? And then he goes on to say, you should understand that no thing ever falls short of its own completeness. Wherever it stands, it never fails to cover the ground. So think about the moments when you feel incomplete and insufficient, when others have so much finer qualities, when they're getting ahead and you're falling behind. They're succeeding and you're failing. In that very moment, stop and see, where have you positioned yourself? And I think what we'll find is our mind is populated with many people, many things, and we have put ourselves at a distance from ourselves. And if in your using your meditation, if you can let go of all of that, all of those concerns, all of those people, all of those things, and come back to right where you are in this moment, then that self-doubt will fall away. Because it only can exist in comparison to. The Catskill Mountains can only be low in comparison to a taller mountain. They don't know that. They are fine. Always. Everything in and of itself is fine, always. You and I are like that. But because of our conscious mind, right, we see things in relation to, and then we add meaning. And we are taught what those things mean, how to grade, what standard of measurement we use to rank high and low, worthy and unworthy, deserving and undeserving, superior and inferior. And then we build systems to perpetuate that. And violence. And that's why the Buddha said, there is no quality or characteristic that you can put that can differentiate you inherently from another, not through your hair or head, not your eyes or ears, not your face or nose, not your mouth or lips, not your neck or shoulders, not your belly or back, not your buttocks or chest, not your groin or intercourse, not through hands or feet, fingers or nails, calves or thighs, complexion or voice. Why is he being so thorough? What was the need for him to go through such an inventory? Because we can seize on any of those. Okay, not this, but this. And he's saying, no. He said, all of this identification is described, should be understood simply in terms of convention. We differentiate and discriminate for the reason of convention. Whose convention? For what purpose? To fulfill what desire? To establish what superiority? To give who benefits? And so this is why in our Beyond Fear of Differences work, we're taking these teachings and just using them, because that's what practitioners do to understand our time and place, this universal teaching that has a profound impact and significance for our particular time and place, right? In this country, with our history, systemic racism, sexism, transphobia, homophobia, all of the different ways we attach to some of those features and impute inherent meaning. And the Buddha said that is a form of violence that will lead to explicit forms of violence. It is inevitable. Why else would it be used? Why else would it be using that scale? What is the origin of that scale that we use to evaluate? And what the Buddha is saying is it's all based on an illusion. That everyone gets fought in, it's caught in. It's really a difference of phobia. Our brains are wired to experience differences, but it's society that tells us over and over and over and over what those differences mean. And our practice is to free ourselves of that, those, all of those forms of confusion, of misunderstanding, Because all the while, this inconceivable Dharma is abundant in every person. Is there anyone who is not fine? Is there anyone who is not complete? Is there anyone who is who is Buddha? Some are tall, some are short, some are light, some are dark. Some are young, some are old. All Buddhas, all cover the ground upon which they stand, upon which we stand. And so to see the totality of existence, the totality of humanity in each and everything, in each and every person. So to think about this remembrance of September 11th and the mass delusion that led to that, that followed that, the incalculable suffering. When we look at it that way, when we look at delusion that way, we realize this is not a abstract, philosophical, idle thing. This is not the kind of thing we should get to whenever the kids have been put to bed and the dishes have been washed and all the work is done and everything. And then if there's time, I'll try and sort out all the pain and suffering of the world. Tadaroshi says, if you speak of gain and loss, you are a person of gain and loss. Isn't this exactly what the Buddha said? Isn't this karma? What we give rise to in our mind is the person that we perceive ourselves to be. The image, the view, the understanding that we give rise in our mind about each other is not only the person we create about ourselves, but the person we create about others. So in that way, we, in a sense, assume the role of a god, creating and destroying. The Buddha said it does not have to be this way. I was meeting with a group of students yesterday who were preparing to do Jikai, and one of the students, and so these are all practitioners of some years, and they're getting ready to take vows in the Bodhisattva path, and a student was talking about how he's realize he's getting more and more sensitive and sort of attuned and awake to the suffering of the world. And he says, does it actually get harder? And I said, yes, it does actually. In the best way possible, it gets harder. Because what was hard before was so much harder. You know, I remember times being so caught and stuck and feeling self-doubt. It's like, I can't do this, and who am I kidding? And why don't I just give everybody a break and just get out of here? Right? And I would think, where am I going to go? Right? What's next? Where am I going to go that I don't go there too? And bring it all along with me. And that really helped because, like, just stop whining and complaining and just get back to it. And so, you know, I encourage those of you here for the weekend to trust whatever brought you here. In whatever direction that flame takes you, keep feeding that fire. Dogen said it's a little bit like holding an infant in your arms, right? It's kicking, it's screaming, it's got full of life, but it's fragile. It's fragile. It has to be attended to, has to be cared for, has to be fed. So I'll end with a poem. Bright blue boasting sky, autumn breeze, brings the first tumbling leaves. Each leaf fragile and passing, and even now dried with curled edges, is itself a giver of life without knowing. Everything is sufficient in its own way, regardless of what the drunken people may say. For after all, they too are the rightful heirs of this season's bountiful harvest. And this season's bountiful harvest is every day.
Thanks so much for listening. To find out more about the monastery's programs, weekend retreats, and residency, please visit our website at cmm.org.